Now, our initial plan, we had planned to record this pod before the men's final, probably preemptively congratulate Novak Djokovic.
Yes.
And the reason we were going to do this was because of the small matter of that football match, which was now last night. Basically, again, our schedules, they aligned once. They've aligned once in, what, 2 years?
It's sort of ridiculous. I mean, at one point each day, we saw each other swapping ends of the grounds. So you moving from centre to one, and I was swapping from one to centre. So we were just, hi, bye. We just were at opposite ends the entire time.
We were like, there's a window, then something comes up, as it does in tennis, and things move around. And then we're rushing off and we've got to get here. And so the plan of recording on the Saturday changed, and then with the football last night we were rushing back to respectively watch it, and now it feels weird after everything that happened with the football that I've sort of forgotten the tennis.
Yeah. No, it was a busy day, wasn't it? I did feel bad that we had talked about potentially pre-recording a bit on Djokovic getting 20, because Berrettini has been so good, and it is it is sort of disrespectful as much as it's also realistic. It is a little bit not great, but I don't think we're the only ones who are sort of talking like that.
And I think it was sort of tongue in cheek, wasn't it? I think if we'd actually recorded on the Saturday, we wouldn't. We would have said we believe he probably will, because we both tipped him at the start of the tournament. But that was probably about as far as we were going to go. And now we're sitting here on Monday lunchtime, and the football seems to have sort of overshadowed everything.
Wow.
I mean, it's just,
that does happen in Britain.
I mean, it does, doesn't it? I remember driving back from Wimbledon yesterday. Everyone was kind of rushing to get a train, go to a friend's house, be with people to watch. For people thinking, what are you talking about? To watch England against Italy at Wembley in the final of the delayed Euro 2020 Championships. And driving back, there were no cars on the road. It was quite weird. And then as I was walking from my house to my parents, where everyone had gathered to watch it, and we'd got pizzas and we were ready, you could see all the televisions and all the people gathered in their front rooms. And then it goes to penalties. And the boys' school had sent an email saying, due to wanting everyone to be part of this occasion, that they could come in late for school. So no, I didn't tell the boys this, because then they'd be like, great, so we're going in at like 2 o'clock. And I'm like, no, you're not. And they could also wear football kits.
Nice.
So they could wear England and Italy football kits. He's only got a French one, but as it's blue and Italy wear blue, so I just sent him in his French kit.
Close enough.
Like, in you go. So I thought it was close enough. So they went to bed about 11:30 last night. So I'm not sure what they're going to be like at around 6 o'clock this evening, but they went in fine in their kits. But it's just, I think it's that emotional release that you get after a Grand Slam anyway. And then you add in that final at Wembley. And I'm a bit like, oh.
Well, it was a long day, and a long day for a lot of people who were at the tennis, including Matteo Berrettini. Yeah. He found his way to Wembley. There must have been choppers involved, because that is not a journey you can do in that sort of time. Do you know what I mean? Because Tom Cruise was there, and doesn't Tom Cruise fly helicopters? He probably flew them all there.
Didn't someone tell me that Tom Cruise had flown in by helicopter to the women's final? So therefore,
probably.
I assume he did the same thing for the men's.
But you also had Kate, Duchess of Cambridge. She was at the men's final, wasn't she? And then she went to Wembley. So
not in Tom Cruise's helicopter.
In my head,
in
my head, you've got Tom Cruise flying a helicopter with Kate in there, Matteo Berrettini, and he's doing all these stunts. You know, there's somebody dangling off the back, and he's diving down. He's like, oh, we're going into a mountain.
I was about to like add in the Mission Impossible soundtrack while you were talking to see if we could like really build that picture. Can you imagine? Anyone want a lift? I got my helicopter out back, and there's Kate.
But they must have. There's no way they could have got there in time.
Yeah, they could have. What about like a bike courier? You can go on the back of a bike. Or as tennis players, were you allowed to? Because I know footballers aren't allowed to go on motorbikes. You know, they sign contracts. They can't ski, and they can't buy a motorbike. So as is it different because you're individual? So a team is buying, a club is buying a footballer and therefore saying, right, you will not do this, this and this. Mm. But I imagine as a tennis player, there's no kind of restrictions on you.
Yeah, rubbish being bought by somebody else. You're then just owned by them, aren't you? Which just is not ideal. No, tennis players do what you want. A lot of them sort of avoid that stuff. But do what you want. It's up to you. You only ruin your own career, don't you?
But what a roller coaster of emotions for Matteo Berrettini. I mean, it... building yourself up to the Wimbledon final, something he said he couldn't even really dream about. Being out there, taking that first set, fighting as hard as he could. Djokovic wins. You do your media. And before it even sinks in, you're at Wembley. And then your side on penalties, because everyone kept missing their penalties, are European champions.
Yeah.
it's a day, isn't it?
I definitely think he'd be pretty exhausted, for sure. But I mean, if we talk about his match, like his... tennis was so good. I mean, you couldn't really have asked for anything more from somebody in their first Grand Slam final. I mean, even before that, just getting to the final, the fact that he was turning up and everybody was saying he's the favourite to come through the bottom half, get to the final, including me, I was saying it. But then he just did. He's never been to a Grand Slam final before. He's only been in one semi-final. So to actually just be the favourite, have some nervy moments, scrap through, play some great tennis, get to the final, and then actually just sort of get on with it and give Djokovic a really good go. He didn't crumble. He didn't do anything really wrong. Of course, there are elements of his game he could have done better. You know, to beat Djokovic, you pretty much have to be perfect. Those are the requirements. And he was a little bit off at times. But at times, he really nailed it. So it was really good fun, I think. I'm glad the crowd, you know, really enjoyed it. I think we'll see him in more finals.
I think that's what we also saw, the gap that is still there. And I think this gap, it's a sort of a twofold gap. The gap between Djokovic playing at his very, very best is still stunning. And also, they just haven't... the people coming up against him now in the latter stages of a Grand Slam, the semis or the final, just haven't been there before. So they're dealing with all that kind of stuff. There were nerves there from Djokovic because he's now got this goal of the calendar year slam. Can he make it the Golden Slam? So there is pressure on him. There are nerves there. We've said, haven't we, that the person, not necessarily at the Olympics, but at the US Open, say, the only person that probably beat him, if he's playing his best, is probably himself. But there are nerves there. But the guys he's playing are dealing with a lot. They're dealing with realizing a dream of being in a Grand Slam final and everything that comes with it, and then you've got to bring your best tennis against Djokovic, who is in his 30th Grand Slam final. So I mean, gradually they will eat away at that. You know, there'll be a second Grand Slam final appearance and a third, and they will start to deal with it, although he dealt with it well. But then you've still got that gap of Djokovic when he's playing at his best. I mean, some of that tennis yesterday was, well, it was silly. I mean, it was silly at times.
Yeah, I mean, the gap's wider than ever, as far as I'm concerned. I know that Berrettini was up a set, and I know that Tsitsipas was up two sets at the French Open, but they still lost. Like, that's the thing, is that, yeah. I mean, we were having this conversation the other day. I mean, how far in the lead do you have to go to be the favourite to beat Djokovic? Tsitsipas was two sets up in the French, and we probably had him at 50-50. What, so you have to be two sets and a break? Two sets and two breaks? Do you have to be at match point? It is absolutely absurd.
Isn't that crazy? Isn't that crazy that Tsitsipas, two sets up in the Roland Garros final, was still only 50-50? I mean, I remember us talking about that, and I remember thinking that at the time. It's crazy, isn't it? That is still how we think.
It's like Serena now for me, when she was dominating. It's the same, as in if Serena turns up and plays 60%, she wins the slams. And it's the same for me for Djokovic. I don't think he played. He had patches where he played really well. I mean, that fourth set was amazing. But it's not like he produced all of his matches through the Grand Slam. He didn't produce a Grand Slam performance that we've actually seen from him before. I don't think that was his best tennis all in all, but he still won it. And I think that he individually now, because we haven't had this in the men's game for a long time, because there's always been a few of them at the top and you've always had Rafa on the clay. And I actually think that he individually now is head and shoulders above everybody else, which has never been the case. Federer is slipping a little bit, and Nadal, well, I don't think we can really write him off until we see how he turns up to Roland Garros next year, because this year he got tired and he was a bit done. Will that just continue? Is that just an age thing that's just going to continue to happen? If it is, then Djokovic is going to be the favourite there as well. So he's just... there's just a big distance. There's a big gap now, isn't there, between him and the rest of the field? And there will be a big gap soon enough between him and Federer and Nadal when it comes to the amount of Grand Slams won.
How much from looking at him, do you feel Federer has slipped, or can you not judge it because he just hasn't had the weight of matches?
It's difficult, isn't it? I mean, it's a six love set. That's the concerning bit. That is not something that Federer would ever accept. That is, you know, he went out with a bit of a whimper. It wasn't, he didn't go down fighting. That's the concerning bit. Not that he lost. You know, you can see how he would lose a match. You know, he's not walking in as the heavy favourite. He's walking in as a contender who hasn't had many matches. So I don't think losing is really a big deal. I think if he had just lost, it would be sort of like, okay, well, he needs more matches, and you know, he didn't do well in Halle, and that was unfortunate. He really needed to get, if he had won that tournament, he would have had those extra matches coming in and that sort of thing. But yeah, it was just sort of the manner of it was really, really quite interesting. And also the way that he played in the rounds before. I mean, he managed to win some matches that were kind of on the edge there. The errors that were flying off his racket, it was out of control at times.
I think, and we always look at stats, but it was his first six love set at Wimbledon. First time he's lost in straight sets at Wimbledon since 2002, Mario Ancic. And something like it's his second six love set of the 21st century. I mean, it's not something that happens. And interestingly, I can't remember, I think it might have been Leon Smith or maybe Pat Cash, who we were alongside, said they thought at the end of the match, when they come out and they put the microphone out for the winner, so Hubert Hurkacz to speak, they felt there was a quiet word in Federer's ear, almost to say, would you like to say something? As in, is this going to be your last time here? Because it's not normal that they'll go and speak to the person that loses. Do you see what I mean?
Oh, wow. Maybe they know something.
Wow. Or maybe they just, I mean, okay, do you think right now here, Monday afternoon, Wimbledon's finished, are we going to see Federer? If he's fit and healthy, are we going to see him next year? Or do you think his tennis career will be done?
I really have no idea. I mean, you could see it either way. I think he'll give it another go. I think he will. Yeah. I think we'll see him next year. But honestly, I could not be surprised if there's an announcement in the next couple of weeks, to be honest. You just don't really know, do you? Because, I mean, he wants to be winning slams, and or at least competitive for winning slams. I don't think he just wants to be playing and winning a match here or there. Like, that's what he wants to do. So it's just about whether or not he believes that he can.
So we have all three of them on 20. Wasn't it the first Grand Slam title for Djokovic? Wasn't it something like 2008 in Australia? And he's pretty much since then spent the whole time chasing Nadal and Federer. And now they are all aligned at 20. And he can just keep going. I mean, 25, 26?
Yeah, possible? I think so. I mean, it's a wonderful narrative, isn't it, to have them all on 20. For people outside the sport, when we get to the US Open, it's going to be a really big deal. I also think it's going to be great for Djokovic, the fact that he's sort of overtaken them together, because he is ultimately going to absolutely love that he is now ahead of both Federer and Nadal at the same time and is the undisputed best ever Grand Slam collecting player. Is that a thing? I don't know.
It can be.
And well on his way to being, you know, an incredibly, you know, loved player. I mean, he is so loved in so many parts of the world, but it's tough, isn't it, when you're up against those couple of guys. But now that they're winding down, I think there'll be more sort of respect and understanding. I think far more love is going to be coming Djokovic's way, and it's so rightly deserved. It is absolutely bonkers what he's doing. But yeah, not stopping. I mean, he's won all the Masters twice, he's won all the Slams twice, and yeah, that it's just that Olympic gold, isn't it? But that's going to be tough.
That's going to be tough because it's over three sets, and you sometimes get this narrative, this story. You get a player who rises to the occasion. You can get fairy tales that happen at the Olympics. Strange things happen at the Olympics. Look, you know me. I'm going with Kei Nishikori for gold. That's my romantic Olympic fairy tale. It's in Tokyo. This is what his whole life has been about.
Well, hey, we have Monica Puig.
You see, and he's fit and he's healthy and he's Or Andy Murray, he's taken that sort of wild card because he's a former champion, a Grand Slam champion. They have certain categories of how you can get in, and it's how many Grand Slam titles he won if you're Olympic champion. And Andy Murray more than qualifies for that place, which is why he has taken his spot in the team. Is that going to be the romantic narrative? Will Roger Federer, as things stand, he's on the Swiss entry list. Is he going to go? Because that's the big thing missing from the major awards. I mean, he's won everything, but if you look, there's that he's got doubles gold, hasn't got singles. So it's just so the Olympic gold, it's still, I wouldn't be as certain he will get that as I am that he will probably get the US Open when we get there.
Is it the best of three thing?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And it's this romantic narrative of the Olympics. It's just,
I think the best of three is a big difference, isn't it? I mean, yeah. I know that Djokovic has still been so dominant at Masters events, but you've got to think that, you know, the Tsitsipases, even, you know, Hurkacz, Berrettinis, Medvedevs, they are going to be so confident that they can beat him in three. Because a lot of them have, some of them haven't, a lot of them have done it before. I mean, you know, most of them have not beaten him in five at all. So I think, it just makes it a little more doable. They've got to produce that level for two sets. As Tsitsipas did in the French Open final and didn't get anywhere with it. You know, you have to produce that level for a certain amount of time. And Djokovic has to be off his game for a certain amount of time. And it's just a little bit more doable, I think. So that would be a big factor. So
then I'm thinking, though, now there's no crowds at all at the Olympics as things stand. And they said they would revisit it for home fans if cases start to improve in Japan, but Tokyo is now in an extended state of emergency situation. It's someone like Tsitsipas hates not having a crowd there. Nick Kyrgios pulled out because he said, you know, I can't, you know, I need a crowd, because he was originally on the entrance list for Australia. I think he's in the Bahamas at the moment. But he said, you know, without crowds, I can't do it. And we know Tsitsipas doesn't react to not having crowds there. So that's a kind of, and look, there's my romantic Kei Nishikori to win gold. He might have to do it in an empty stadium. So how does that affect, you know, you could be anywhere. You know, it's not necessarily that home advantage that you talk about. It's not going to be there, essentially, because there is not going to be anybody there. And some players are not going for that reason, others because of bubble life reasons. There are a few like Dominic Thiem who are injured. But it's just more of a lottery, I think, in that competition. So I think he's nailed on for the US. Look, there's people like Denis Shapovalov. I was so happy to see Shapovalov play as he did. And even in that straight set semi-final defeat to Djokovic, he played so well. Yes, disheartening that you can play at that level and still lose in straight sets. But it was really nice to see him have that confidence and play that kind of tennis.
Yeah, I mean, if he was able to produce his best tennis on the big points, then he could have been at 2-1 up instead of off the court having lost three sets to love. So, you know, he gave himself a real, real chance. And you just can't really ask any more of anyone than that. It just in terms of the way that Djokovic is playing, the level of experience that he has. It's like you're saying, it's all new for them, isn't it? I mean, Shapovalov did so well. It's a new situation for him. He just got stuck in. He kept just throwing everything at him. I thought he was fantastic. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Shap. I think he's going to be awesome. I think he's going to win slams. I can't wait to see it.
I kind of want him to stop rapping, though.
I'm not a fan of him as a rapper.
Well, I did an interview on Five Live, and it was in the it was in one of the shows when they're a bit more kind of, they like to have a bit of fun, and so we got on and it was talking about Shapovalov and his rapping, and I remember saying that it's really strange with Denis Shapovalov, because he's such a sort of nice guy and you talk to him and then he's rapping about sort of chains and swearing and gangs, and there was someone on Twitter that said, I can't believe you're being so stereotypical about rapping, it's not all about blings and swearing and gangs. And I was like, no, but that's what he did.
Yeah. that was the topic of his rap.
Yeah, I wasn't being stereotypical, this was the topic of his rap, and I'm not saying it would be of all of them, but it was funny, on the show they just wanted to talk about him rapping, and I was like, please, can we talk about the tennis? I don't want to talk about the drip or the night
but
train.
They do. I mean, they always love a bit of colour, don't they? So anything, whether it's Konta's baking or something like that.
And it can bring people in, can't it? It can bring... One thing I noticed was how nervous Matteo Berrettini's parents were. I mean, his father was quite literally plucking the hairs out of his beard. He couldn't look. He was looking at... And his mother, and this went around social media, I think she was giving herself and the person next to her, those calming drops. You know, you can get this homeopathic
rescue remedy.
Yeah, those. I think she was rescue remedying the whole team.
Yeah, she was.
Outside of the bubble team.
And you always got the feeling, I'm sure she wasn't, but you always got the feeling they were doing it like every change of ends. Just like, we need to calm down. We need to calm down.
More drops, people, more drops. It's homeopathic.
We're out, we're out.
It's more drops. And I remember saying to Marion Bartley during our coverage, what, maybe your dad was different because he was your coach, but what were your family like when they watched? And she was like, well, I don't know if you remember my dad, but when I won Wimbledon, it's like I'd won some 15K tournament in the back streets of wherever. And I was like, okay. And she said, but her mum got very, very nervous and wouldn't always come to matches. And it was just, there was that sort of contrast between the two. But the Berrettini family were, wow.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So in stark contrast to that, we have sort of the Ash Barty group who they don't give anything away. She had a boyfriend, Gary, there, Craig Tizer, a coach. And they, I kept looking up thinking, I mean, they let out a huge roar when she won the title, beat Pliskova. But that whole team, Barty included, doesn't give you a lot, do they?
Oh, I know. Stoic, aren't they?
Yeah.
And Craig Tizer, I mean, sometimes he just has sort of like a half smile on his face. And that's sort of about it. But that's just so his personality. I mean, even when Ash was just paying him just the highest compliments of saying that he's the best coach out there and I'm so lucky to work with him and stuff, he just sort of was like, huh, cheers. It's just so funny.
And I quite like the Karolina Pliskova in her post-match interview. She wanted to thank her team and her husband, Michael, was there and her coach, Sasha Bayen. And I quite like the credit she gave to Sasha Bayen because I think, and you don't know the backstory and the ins and outs of everything, but he seemed to come in for a bit of a rough ride when he parted with Naomi Osaka for the reasons that they know. And then he was with Yastremska and that didn't end well. And the start of the Pliskova relationship, she hasn't, you know, she got double bageled in Rome. But I remember her saying in Eastbourne, this wasn't a quick thing. You know, we're in it for the long haul. We're working together and we have a plan. And she said at the end, I owe him massive credit. Now, he did say before the final, I knew when she came back from 2-5 down in the first set of her first round match that she was going to be here 2 weeks later. I mean, hindsight's a beautiful thing. But it's, I think he, and my dealings with him have always very been nice. He's been polite. I think there must be something about him as a coach. He's producing results with player after player.
Yeah. I mean, he's working at the highest level. He knows what's required on the court. And I mean, absolutely has brought out the best in Pliskova because she was not in a good place
for a number
of reasons. And I know we've talked a lot about her struggling through lockdown, but even before then, her game was really struggling. And I have to hold my hands up and say, I mean, last summer, I suppose, I was saying that I think that's it. I think her chance of winning Grand Slam title is gone. And that was because there was that sort of power vacuum when Serena went away on maternity leave. And there was opportunity. I mean, I say power vacuum. I mean, there was some fantastic players.
I love that Kerber, phrase, power vacuum.
Yeah, it was Kerber, Muguruza, Halep. But everybody was tussling around and it really felt like the slams were up for grabs. And they do feel up for grabs now in a sense. But particularly up until this Wimbledon, Pliskova had never done well at Wimbledon by her standards of being former number one in the world. She'd done better on the hard court. Eventually been to the final of the US Open. So I was sort of thinking about those hard court events and thinking, well, I mean, they are just going to be hoovered up by Osaka and Andreescu, aren't they, really? Let's be honest here. They are head and shoulders when it comes to hard court tennis above the rest of the field. And I thought maybe she's missed her chance. But, you know, of course, Wimbledon, you know, she really got it together well. We didn't have Osaka. We had a very injured Andreescu who, quite frankly, looked at grass like it was a different planet. she just went, what is this? Could barely play and lost fairly swiftly. So actually, you know, things... you know, in her half of the draw, definitely, you know, opened up a bit more. But she played brilliantly well. I mean, against Sabalenka in the semis, I thought she was absolutely outstanding. Yep. She played some of the best tennis I've ever seen her play. Not only did I think that she'd missed her opportunity to win a slam, I also thought that we'd seen the best of her. And I take that back fully now. She was fantastic in that semi-final. It was more difficult in the final for her. It's a very different game style to play against. But she really showed Sabalenka in that semi-final, like, look, you cannot just come out here and just hit everything really hard. And I think that was really great for me because it shows everybody that Pliskova is not just a hard strike. She's not just a power hitter and a pop on her serve and oh, well, I'll just roll through some matches. That she thinks that she has some good hand skills now up around the net. Some of the pickups she made up short were tremendous. And then taking Sasha Bay in, having him on board, clearly the tactics are working really well. And actually, I felt like Sabalenka was shown up a little bit in that semi-final, as much as I loved her run and I love power tennis, as just being in that particular match quite straightforward and simple. And Pliskova was like, that's not good enough. I've been a world number one. I'm on my way to the final. You're going to have to do better than that. And Sabalenka wasn't able to. But I think that just shows the difference because there are nuances between the power players. And I think you could really see that there was a lot more thought in the Pliskova game than there was in Sabalenka in that match.
And I think it shows that she doesn't feel she's done yet by hiring Sasha Bayin, because I can't imagine he's cheap. And that's not a crass thing, it's an honest thing to say. She's investing in a very experienced coach because she wants to get the best. She's, what, 29? I don't think I've made that up. I think that could be right. She's 29 and she wants... She's a former world number one. She'd been to a Grand Slam final at the US Open before. She wants to squeeze every last drop out of her talent. I think it shows a big commitment hiring someone like Sasha Bayin, and I think on his part as well. I don't think he's going to link up with a player who he feels is probably at the limit of where they're going to go or doesn't have the drive. So I think when you see matchups, like even when Dan Evans linking up with his new coach, you know, it shows they think, well, hang on a second, let's see what is possible, let's take that step. Because, and we come back again to players, but, and I know, look, she's got a lot of money, but it's still an investment. It's, I remember speaking to a coach a couple of years ago about some of the players, and I would say, well, why do you think X or Y hasn't gone on, or why? And he said, because they're not investing in themselves, they are the product. And they have to make that step. And early in their career, it might seem like a massive step because they don't have all the money. But they have to put that money in themselves. Even if they go into debt, they've got to invest and see what is possible. And I know it's easy when Pliskova's got millions and millions to invest. But it's still, for me, a statement. It's still making a commitment to saying, I'm not done yet. And let's see where I can go. And what it's proved at this stage is, you know, they've reached a Grand Slam final together.
Yeah, it's so good to see. I mean, I love Pliskova when she's playing well. I really want her to pick up a Grand Slam title. I think it's going to be really tough. We've seen how difficult it's been for Serena just consistently being the second best player in the tournament. Not very recently, but up until the last couple of years, being the second best player. It's always just been that one player. And I feel like Pliskova might end up in that situation. Look, she came up against Barty, who was playing at such a great level. And okay, look, she really challenged her, but it still felt like it was Barty's match, really, to lose there. So, yeah, and when you talk about the investing in coaches, I mean, whoever was saying that is correct. You really need to be piling in all of the resources that you have into the experience, because you need that. Even if they're not your main coach, but somebody as a consultant, you need somebody that has that experience. You can't just feel your way through. It just doesn't work like that, really. But there are a lot of players that know they need to do that and don't want to do that because they're sort of fine where they are as well. So, you know, I do agree that players need to do that if they want to be the best they can be. But not all players do. I think... You know, sometimes they're sort of happy enough. If they're sitting at 50, 60, they're, you know, no problem. Or if they're at 30, you know, well, how much do you have to invest? How hard do you have to work to maybe get to 20? It's, you know, those conversations always go on. But in Pliskova, right from the beginning of her career, she's clearly been somebody who's wanted to maximize her potential. I mean, she got to number one in the world. And when she first broke into the scene, even when she got to the top 10, people were saying that she was far too one-dimensional. She can't move. She doesn't make enough balls. She needs to go cross-court more, whatever it is. And she didn't really listen to them. I mean, she did improve in a lot of those areas, but it wasn't like she was panicking, thinking, I need to do X, Y. She just got better and better year on year. And when she was number one in the world, she was playing unbelievably, so consistent as well. With a game star like hers, all, you know, people saying flat strike, you know, you just sort of go for it and try and hit winners. It's not a steady game. It's not a consistent game. But week in, week out, she was producing. So I think she's fantastic. And I feel a bit bad that I said last year that she was done.
Well, I think if you hadn't said it, reminded us of it, we wouldn't have remembered.
I
think you've just put it back out. I think I've got two Grand Slam achievements this year.
Okay, great.
Not eating a baguette at the French Open.
Yeah, I mean, that is... But that's the second time you've done that, though.
It's the second time I've done that. Yeah. It doesn't mean it's easier, just because it's the second time. It doesn't get any easier.
It's like winning a Grand Slam, isn't it?
It just doesn't get any easier. You know, because you get older and just maybe your willpower... Well, I've never really had much sort of food willpower. Wimbledon, I avoided the donuts and the crisps and those kind of things. So I did that all through Wimbledon. Because a member of our team had his birthday and all these donuts appeared. The crisps, literally, I could not... They were by the door.
I had some of the
they
crisps.
And I don't blame you for doing that, because they were literally everywhere you turned. I spoke last week of trying to do some work and there was a curly whirly. Oh, one of our listeners said that bummed is a universal word, which I thought it was a universal word, because, you know, you thought that people bummed is
British. Being
bummed
out.
I think it sounds quite American, actually. Maybe. Quite bummed. But the curly whirly did need an explanation, because they don't have curly whirlies.
Yeah, well, curly whirlies are ultimately a rip off because there's just lots of holes in them. So, but they are there very long.
Oh, rip off in terms of you're paying a lot of money and you haven't got
just get a lot of air, don't you? Yeah. But no, they are very long. Maybe that makes up for it. I'm not sure.
So that was my second achievement, was just staying away from the snacks, because they are, and it's wonderful that they're provided to keep us going, but they're everywhere.
I mean, I have a different approach to Grand Slams. It's very much snack focused to get me through. It's coffee and snack focused. That's about it.
Is it quite strange that I don't drink coffee? I still get people who are very... I've never ever... It's not a health thing. I've never had a cup of coffee in my life.
Well, I don't think it's strange.
Some people think it is a sort of shocked... They sort of, how do you function?
Maybe it's just because you're so perky all the time. They just think you must be on caffeine.
Do you think I'm perky?
No comment.
I don't necessarily think I'm perky, but sometimes people are like, how are you doing this without coffee? The honest answer is I don't know, because I've never drunk it.
Because we do work long days and we do have to be on it,
perky,
sharp and perky. So caffeine is the backbone of the media world.
It's the love of the job. Do you see Ash Barty dominating?
Nope.
Okay. Is it? Why not?
Because it's Osaka. And, with an asterisk, Andreescu. But no,
why
I don't...
Why has Andreescu got the asterisk? Because you haven't seen enough, or because she's always injured?
Because, well, yeah, exactly. If she plays, she can obviously do some big things.
So basically, because of the strength and depth, because you can throw in a Świątek and Sabalenka's finally made a deep run at a Grand Slam. So are you saying that Barty won't, because there's too many other good players around her?
I think... Look ahead to the US Open. It's not that far away. Osaka's going to be the favourite. Australian Open, Osaka's going to be the favourite. French Open, Barty's probably going to be the favourite.
Because of her game style on those courts.
Yeah, she's so good on hard courts.
Because she's won it.
Well, because she's won it and because she's so good on hard courts. Like, I mean, she is, she has that sewn up. But I do think that Barty is exceptionally good when it comes to clay and grass now. Her game has adapted really well. I think it's going to be more difficult for the likes of Osaka to adapt to particularly grass. I think that is, it's not necessarily easy.
And is it because it feels like, not that she doesn't want to, but because people just talking through this, you've got to have the belief, you've got to want to, you've got to embrace it, you've got to give it a cuddle, you've got to, like Djokovic, you've got to eat it.
People don't understand. I think a lot of people focus on what the ball does through the surface, and Pliskova has talked about this a lot. Okay, her strike is amazing on a grass court. We get that. But do you know what? Her movement is very difficult on a grass court. She's very upright. She's very tall. And everybody tells you when you go on grass, you've got to get low. You've got to get down there in the grass. It's something really hard for her. If you can't move, then you can't strike. It doesn't matter how good your strike is. If you can't get there and be balanced and get to the next ball when your pace is redirected, you're absolutely stuffed. So I think, as I say, people get very sucked into just seeing what the ball is doing, and actually it is much, much more about the movement when it comes to playing, particularly on grass but also on clay. And I think that is something that requires a lot of work, a lot of knowledge and experience. You have to have different footwork patterns. You can't slow down as quickly. Everything in terms of your approach up to a shot is entirely different on a grass court. And I actually think that, you know, one of the reasons we're seeing so many players slip over all the time now on grass is because the ball comes through the bounce a bit more like a hard court because of the new technology. But you can't move like you're on a hard court because you're on grass and it's slippery. Yeah. You know, yeah. On a hard court, you have maximum grip and friction. You do not have much friction on a grass court, and it's different on clay again. So I just think that that those sorts of transitions are tough to make. And at the moment, for me, I think that the favourite for slams on clay and grass are going to be Ash Barty, and on hard is going to be Osaka. With the exception, if Andreescu could just play for a few months, then okay, you know. She did so well in Miami. But if she could just get going. Because that is impressive. I mean, that was out of the blue. She'd barely played at all and she makes a final there. It's absolutely stunning. We cannot forget about her, but she's not playing. I don't want her to turn into a Del Potro. That would be awful.
And I think we need her. I think the women's game needs her because she's got a presence. I remember, I don't know if I said this on the pod, but when I was at Eastbourne and I was doing the interviews with a range of the top players, from Ons Jabeur to Karolina Pliskova, et cetera, et cetera. One of them is Bianca Andreescu. She has is that too strong a word? But she has a presence. She has a presence. When you think she's a Grand Slam champion and she's won Indian Wells, but she hasn't done that much in the span of things. And she's still very young. But she has a presence about her. She has a character. She's fun. And as she was, and I was really excited about interviewing her because of the character, because of this presence that she has. I think she's really good for the sport. I think the way she talks, I think the way she plays, I think she's a great addition to throw into this mix when you look at the characters out there. And she's such a fighter. When you get her on court, I mean, even if her arm's hanging off, she's still going to the point where I literally can't continue. And she did say, look, I've got to think more carefully now. Everything I've been through, I have to be more careful. But I really hope she can get back up and running. I think the women's game needs. I think it's got lovely characters, wonderful characters. You've got different characters. They all bring something: game styles, personalities. But I do think it needs Andreescu.
Yeah, and if you want to see, in terms of a visual representation as to why it is difficult for hardcourters to play on grass when they have no experience on it, watch the Andreescu match from Wimbledon and you will see somebody very much struggling to know what to do, where to hit, how to move, and all of it. And it is frustrating as well. We missed the grass court season last year, barely any lead up this year. So, I mean, yeah, for somebody like her, it was always going to be rough.
Oh, look, she's played 6 or 7 matches in her whole career on the serve, and she's still very good. Overall, how did you enjoy your Wimbledon experience? We didn't have it, as you said, last year. We missed it. How was it for you in 2021?
Oh, I mean, it was incredible. It was amazing, and finished with two really fantastic finals, and two finals that could have threatened, particularly after the opening sort of 20 minutes of both of those finals, to be incredibly one-sided, because we had that long run of points that Ash Barty won. Was it 14? Was it 14 or 15? You were on it.
Yep, 14.
14 points in a row. So that was, and you get the sort of big cheer when Pliskova finally gets a point on the board. And that, you know, this is the Wimbledon final. This is not a pity party. It's not nice at all for that to be the situation. Djokovic raced away in that first set, but then Berrettini I don't know how he managed to win that set. It was unbelievable how he turned it around. But you know what I mean? It sort of, it had that little bit of, oh, okay, this could be over quite quickly. And then they were fantastic finals. I mean, the whole tournament has been awesome. I really enjoyed watching the juniors as well. I think particularly the junior girls are in a really strong phase right now. Very, very impressed with the winner of that tournament. The final was great fun to watch. I mean, she was awesome. The Spanish girl. It's been brilliant. It's been back. I can't believe it.
I think the other thing, it's so good to have it back, but I think working as we were for BBC Five Live, we had the continuing thread and story of the football, and that made it very exciting as well, because you had England on this run, you had the Wimbledon taking place, the excitement from the spectators and the crowd, everything that was going on. So it was an amazing experience, sort of weaving those two together. Sadly, for England fans, it wasn't the ending that was wanted, but Italian fans will be very happy. It was a great couple of weeks, and now you and I have got very different weeks ahead of us. I mean,
yes,
very different.
I mean, I'm sort of jealous of you with what you're doing, because you're going to Tokyo and you're going to the Olympics, which is very exciting. But also, I'm having some time off, so I'm also very excited for that.
And I'm very jealous of you. And when you were describing, you were sort of saying, oh, you know, you're playing it down. You were saying, oh, it's a staycation, we're doing this and that. I was thinking, sounds amazing. Even today, just to wake up, no, there was no work today, and I could take the boys to school in their little kit. It was just, it's that kind of release that you need, because Grand Slams are so intense. You know, for people who have worked to them listening, they'll know this. You know, it's 2 weeks and it's everything. You know, you barely get time to do your washing. What's going to happen when middle Sunday goes, I don't know, because on the Monday, we're sitting with Laura Robson and a couple of other people, and we're all saying, yeah, and Marion Bartley, yeah, we did our washing. We're thinking, when are we going to do that next year? It's because, you know, those 2 weeks are... So when you said that you were sort of staying local and you're doing some walking, exploring, I just thought, oh, that sounds... Yes. So, but and Tokyo's going to be different, because we're coming from... We're a red list country as far as... The UK is a red list country as far as Japan is concerned. So that's like, whoa, not sure we actually want you here. So I've got a week of kind of testing and things and getting lots of stuff in place. I'm very excited about the opportunity to be at an Olympics. It's going to be a restricted Olympics. I'm really lucky that I get to focus my time just on the tennis out there for the world feed. But it's, I'm sort of apprehensive in some sense, because but I'm very excited in another sense. And still, loads of people could pull out. I mean, but up until the day before, they could pull out. And we're already seeing in America, I mean, the people that aren't going. It's going to be great. It's just, in this Monday, it's quite overwhelming. The amount of information, what's needed to be done to even be allowed onto the aeroplane to get there. And when we get there, it's quite a lot.
It feels like the restrictions are going to be tight. But when you're there, once you're in the country, at the site, you're going to be great.
I think it's also like a Grand Slam. Once you get there, you get into your groove, you have your routine. It'll be very similar routine, what you do every day, because again, restrictions. I think it's just, it's winding down from one, winding up into the other, and dealing with an awful lot of documents to read. But very excited. So we're going to try and hook up. Well, schedule-wise, haven't got a clue. So what's the time difference? 8 or 9 hours?
Yeah.
I don't know how that's going to work. But whatever time it is, I will make sure I'm perky.
Good.
Yeah. And on no coffee. And we'll try and get some. I don't know how much of a picture I'll be able to paint, because, as I say, we're quite restricted and we're quite sort of going from sort of A to B. But hopefully I can give you a bit of a feel for the action and who's there and who's playing. And you can just tell me how you're eating loads of great food, going on walks, taking time out. Oh, I'm quite jealous.
Yeah, I know. And speaking of that, I'm going to go right now, because I'm literally about to get in the car and go to my blissful retreat.
Oh, I'm going to go and read some documents. Have a nice holiday. Bye.
Bye.